Takes a little while to get organized here. And I'm sure you've already been welcomed warmly, but I'd like to again welcome you to our 10 days together, a practice period, exploring the Dhamma. And also just to say that it's quite a joy to be back. I haven't been here for, we were trying to figure it out, 6 or 7 years. 7 years, okay. Yeah. Well, it's been a while, and so I'm very happy to be back and reconnect with some old friends and old Dhamma friends and lots of new ones, lots of new Dhamma friends. So glad to be with you. And I'd like to begin the Dhamma talk this evening with a quote from the Buddha. It's in this way that we must train ourselves, by liberation of the self through love. We will develop love. We will practice it. We will make it both a way and a basis. Take our stand upon it, store it up, and thoroughly set it going. So this is the Buddha's instruction for us for the first 5 or 6 days of this retreat, for our practice, for the first 5 or 6 days of this retreat. And you'll probably hear this quote a few more times as we go along. How fortunate it is, actually, that we're embodied as we are in these human forms of ours, so that, in fact, we can cultivate and practice love, can cultivate and practice metta and set it going. The truth is that we're actually quite a minority of life form on this planet. A friend of mine who owns a nursery, a plant nursery, in Taos, New Mexico, where I live, said that there are 5 million bugs, as she called it, insects per human on this planet. So we're quite a small minority, actually. This human body, mind, heart, are really the most conducive towards developing a great, even a boundless capacity of loving kindness, developing compassion, joy, equanimity. Because of our human experience, our particular mix with our human experience of pain and pleasure. Actually, although it may not always seem so, just enough of each. Sometimes there's a little bit more of one, sometimes there's a little bit more of another, sometimes there's many handfuls, seemingly quite a lot of one, and very little of the other. But it actually changes back and forth all the time, within a week, within a day, even within moments. So really this human form that we have, that we embody, offers us the very best conditions that we could possibly ask for. It's sometimes called our precious human existence. In what are sometimes called the lower realms, beings living in these realms, the intensity of suffering is so great in these realms that it's impossible or almost impossible to develop the wholesome qualities of mind, the wholesome qualities of heart that are needed for practice. And I'm sure that every single one of us in this room have been in those lower realms at times. And we know those places of tremendous fire, tremendous contraction, the place where we may feel that it's impossible to connect with the goodness, it's impossible to connect with the beauty, the joy, the love in this life. And then there are what we could call the higher realms or the higher planes of existence, where everything is so blissful, so wonderful, that there's very little inspiration to practice. And I'm sure that every one of us in this room have had at least a few moments, maybe more than a few moments, of being in those realms, where everything, at least for a moment, or maybe a few moments, seems perfect. Kind of totally blissful. And there's really, in those moments, not much inspiration to do anything else. And if we have a practice, it may fly out the window at that point. We forget in those moments that life isn't always so blissful. Life isn't always so perfect. We don't always get what we want. Life doesn't always go our way, we could say. In those moments of bliss, in those moments of seeming perfection, it's easy to forget that we still have our spiritual work to do. So this realm that we live in most of the time, this is the place. This is the place where we can really develop this boundless capacity of the heart, this very natural boundless capacity of the heart. Our human existence is conditioned by certain basic attitudes. And I think that we're all more or less conditioned by these attitudes. So looking at it from the perspective of metta, from the perspective of loving kindness, these attitudes fall into two basic categories, the attitude of generosity and the attitude of non-harming. These are the qualities that really reflect what we could say is our true humanness. When we practice, we cultivate, we deepen, and maybe even bring to maturity these qualities of generosity, non-harming, qualities of a great, deep, unconditional kindness, kindness of heart, kindness of mind. And so again, the Buddha's instruction that we began with a few moments ago. It is in this way that we must train ourselves. By liberation of the self through love, we will develop love. We will practice it. We will make it both a way and a basis. Take our stand upon it, store it up, and thoroughly set it going. Those who have a precious human existence, with all of the conditions, all of the opportunities, all of the blessings in place to be able to meet the Dhamma and to practice the Dhamma, to practice this way of truth, to practice the way of the heart, that these beings are as rare as daytime stars. So, here we are, a room full of daytime stars. With all of the blessings and all of the conditions, all of the opportunities in place for each one of us to be here, to practice the way of the heart. So, loving kindness, metta, unconditional friendship. It's a radiant warmth and an openness. It's an unattached sense of connection, appreciation with no sense of duty, no sense of obligation attached to it. And it arises quite naturally when our attention penetrates through the layer of conditioning that shuts us down to others. So this is what we'll be exploring together through this retreat. And through the first 5 or 6 days of the retreat. And then we'll move into a few days of exploring the equanimity teachings in practice and close the retreat with a couple of days of insight, vipassana practice. Loving kindness. It's a natural, heartfelt wish that's directed towards a particular person or persons, to any being or to a group of beings, wishing them to be happy, wishing them to be at ease. In the process of developing, expanding, and deepening this energy of the heart, one of the things that we begin to taste, to realize, is that our own wants, our own needs, our own preferences are really, in a sense, pale. They're, in certain ways, of course, quite important. But in a sense, they become pale in this incredibly radiant energy of the warmth that begins to flow through the heart in this process of cultivating unconditional kindness, unconditional loving kindness, friendship. We begin this process, this practice, by directing the energy of metta to ourselves. And then we go on by extending it out to others. We wish ourselves and all beings to be well. We wish them to be happy. We wish them to be secure. We wish beings to be at peace. I experience metta as being like the sunshine. That warmth of the sun that permeates our outer sense of presence and then moves inside into our inner sense of being. Human kindness, metta, often can feel like this. It can feel like the sunshine. Our practice of loving kindness is like letting the sun warm our being, warm our heart, our whole being, and then radiating it out to the world around us. The Buddha Dhamma, the teachings and the practices, are about transforming the mind, transforming the heart. We practice, we develop, we prompt this transformation through formal practice, as we'll be doing over these 10 days. But of course, it must flow out and integrate itself into our whole life, our everyday life. And fortunately, this outflow is quite a natural aspect of this process. A couple of important aspects of the Buddha Dhamma that I want to begin to explore with you this evening. And one of them is mindfulness and the other is concentration. Particularly in relationship to metta. Because really there is no metta, there's no practice of metta without concentration and mindfulness. So we'll spend this evening just a little bit of time looking at these two aspects of practice, what they mean, and what they mean in the context of the metta practice. And we'll look at them a little bit more as the retreat goes on into the equanimity and vipassana teachings and practice. So beginning with an example that I think will be quite familiar to everyone in the room in terms of talking about a focused attention, a concentrated attention. When we listen to music, when we really listen to music, focusing all of our attention, our whole being, we could say, into listening to the music, the experience being as though one is absorbed into the music. The poet T.S. Eliot spoke about this in a very beautiful way. He said, "Music heard so deeply that it's not heard at all, that you are the music while the music lasts." This is concentration. A focused attention that's absorbed into the object of attention, which is one aspect of the metta practice. As we practice within the form of metta, the form being the repetition of phrases inwardly over and over and over again, as we do this, we practice focusing in a very deep, very clear, laser-like, one-pointed attention directly into the metta phrases. We also direct our attention as clearly as possible into the object of the metta phrase, whatever we're sending the metta to, or who we're sending the metta to. So in a sense, it's similar to the absorbed attention that you might give to music sometimes. So this is one aspect of our metta practice. We're cultivating and developing a very focused, concentrated attention. I'll also speak a little bit about mindfulness, because it also comes into play. And it's actually very important through this whole 10 days of practice. The knowing that one is absorbed in the music, as an example, is mindfulness. The knowing that one's absorbed in the music. So I hope you see the difference. We couldn't be absorbed in something and not really be aware of it. But the knowing that, in fact, the attention is absorbed into the music or the metta phrases, that's mindfulness. That's mindful awareness. Mindful presence. When we're mindful not only of what we're doing, but we also might be, for instance, mindful of the feeling tone that arises, the pleasant or the unpleasant feeling tone. Or we might also be aware of a particular emotional tone that arises in relationship to our practice. We may be mindful of a whole panorama of colorations, as I think of it, within us and maybe also around us. And in the practice of metta, many states of mind, many states of body that are metta and that aren't metta arise. And it's very important to know this. So there is mindfulness, mindful practice, mindful attention in metta practice. Be reminding you occasionally as the week goes on about this dance or the balance, the way that these aspects of our practice work together and balance each other and dance together, how they support each other, actually. I think that we have quite a strong habituated conditioning to not remember. I think that we have a very strong habituated conditioning to remain resting in our habits, our conditioned habits. It's a kind of inertia to remain resting in our conditioned habits, to remain resting in an inertia. Life, when we're lost or unaware and resting, we could say, in our conditioned habits, it's as though we're looking through a pair of binoculars that aren't focused. Our perception is very blurred. We experience through this filter, this very blurry filter. We experience all the ideas that we have through a filter, all the preconceptions that we have, all of our various opinions, our judgments, and our seemingly similar past experiences filter the present moment if we're resting in our habitual habit patterns. This is how we see. We see through, we could say, blurry binoculars, blurry glasses. Glasses, as the Buddha talked, eyes that are covered with dust. We're not seeing clearly. A very ordinary example that I think every one of us have experienced at times, and I think it relates very well in terms of the metta practice and connecting with an open heart. So, for instance, we meet a new person, someone we've never met before, someone we've never seen before in our whole life. And we don't actually see them as they are. We might be seeing them in relationship to whatever it is we're thinking about them. There's an attachment to the thoughts about them that are passing through our mind. Even though we've never met this person before, all kinds of thoughts, as I'm sure you're aware of if you reflect on your own experience, all kinds of thoughts and judgments sometimes come up in relationship to a brand new person that we've never seen or met before and never talked to yet even. We might be relating to someone in these first few moments through how much we think we're attracted to him or her, how much we think we like them, how much we find this person quite unattractive or unlikable. Or maybe this person reminds us of somebody else. And so we see this person in relationship to some similar qualities of an entirely different person. Or maybe we might meet this new person in relationship to how we hope that they'll be, or how we want them to be, or maybe how what we hope we'll get from them, or what we hope we won't get from them. And there's a long list you can come up with your own. With all of this, we're not experiencing this person that we've just met in themselves. We're not connecting. We're not seeing them clearly. We're not seeing them fully. Our heart is not open. Our heart is closed. Our mind isn't open. Our mind is stuck in its habituated patterns. I've had the experience of getting to know someone and finding out that, in fact, they're not at all like your preconditioned judgments of them were. They're quite different when you finally get to know them. Without mindfulness, we really don't know. We're not aware of this. We're not aware of it in the moment because we're quite blindly caught in our habits. Without mindfulness, we could say that everything we perceive is like this. Everything we see, everything we taste, hear, smell, touch, everything we think is immediately interpreted back to us in conformity with our habitual thoughts, our habitual patterns, our habitual ways of experiencing. What's going on is that we're living at a distance from experience. We're living at a distance from life itself. And it's kind of like a vicious circle that feeds itself, that feeds the conditioning, the habits. And we become, if we keep going around that same circle, we become more and more on automatic, kind of like a robot. Maybe kind of like our computers. You know, you push the key and out pops what's already in there. Out pop our conditioned responses, our conditioned reactions. So mindfulness is very important in this process of cultivating the heart, cultivating unconditional friendship, kindness, because we have many long-standing and very deep habits that keep us from connecting. Mindfulness practice in conjunction with metta practice is really about bringing everything into a very clear, sharp focus to really see things as they are and maybe see things as though for the very first time. And that's very helpful. A mindful presence in relationship with metta practice is a very powerful way of changing our mind, changing our heart, changing the way that we relate to things, people, the way we relate to situations, the way we relate in this world. Connecting with an open heart, an open mind, allows us to release and transform our habits. And it brings about a very deep purification through our whole being. Sometimes when we practice metta, it may happen that strong fear or anger or even hatred arises. Our practice includes knowing this as well. If an aversive, if afflictive states stick around, because they're probably pretty sure to arise in the process of this practice, if they stick around after they arise and are strong enough, it can be very helpful to move into a mindful relationship to these states, to open to it, the state, as though for the first time. What is this? With an interest. What is this? How is this? Where is this? What does it feel like? Where is it in my body? What's the nature of it? Who probably many of you know of, talked about moving from innocence to innocence as though not knowing anything about it. Can we be that open, that interested, that exploratory in our practice? Can we be that open with what's going on in our body, with what's going on in our mind, with what's going on in our heart? It's really quite transformative if we can do this. It has the potential to transform every situation of our life. It's very powerful. A particular and concise definition of mindfulness, and it'll come up again later in the retreat. This is the definition. A kind of extraordinary attention. A non-judging, non-manipulative, non-grasping, non-rejecting attention to the present moment's experience. I'll repeat that. It's not our ordinary way or our habituated way. A non-judging, non-manipulative, non-grasping, non-rejecting attention to the present moment's experience. And when we're doing this, when we do this, it feels like magic. It's really not our training to be so present, to be so present in the moment with what's happening in our body, in our mind, in our heart. Be non-judging, non-manipulating, non-grasping, non-rejecting, just present to see what is, what's happening, how is it, this magical seeming relationship to things. And by magic, I don't mean the magician's magic. The magician's magic that creates an illusion and then pulls us into this illusion, pulls us into the delusion. This seeming magic of mindfulness, this magic, seeming magic of mindful presence actually takes us out of the illusion. It takes us out of the delusion. It takes us directly into reality. The process of developing a concentrated clarity of mindful presence to what's arising, to what's passing, is really the ground of this practice of unconditional loving kindness. And so we're entering into retreat together. We're entering into our inner life in this form of a silent retreat. And we enter in alone, and we enter in together. We're entering into what is really the most intimate experience of our life. This deep intimacy or growing intimacy with ourself, which as it unfolds, as it blossoms, it becomes the deepest intimacy with all of life. So we're entering into quite a profound, very direct, very simple intimacy through our practice of loving kindness. As we enter into retreat together, there are three particular supports, very particular supports that are available to us here and now that can be helpful. So I'd like to speak about each of these briefly. The first support is silence is a gift, really. This silence that holds us, very gently holds us in itself. Silence is actually quite amazing in certain ways. Silence doesn't expect anything. It doesn't judge. Infinitely patient. Boundlessly spacious. Open. Silence is totally allowing, totally accepting. This container of silence has no boundaries. And it's what everything comes out of and what everything returns to. And of course, within the silence, there's sound. All kinds of sounds that arise and pass. And we'll hear many sounds. You'll certainly be hearing the sound of my voice. You'll hear the sound of other voices at times. You may hear sighs, maybe cries, maybe laughs. we'll hear the sound of chanting together. You may hear the sound of motors. We'll certainly hear the sounds of birds, the wind, maybe the rain. Nature, many sounds in nature. All kinds of sounds arising and passing in the midst of silence. And sometimes we interpret sound as noise. And this is an interesting aspect of our minds to look at. Sometimes we interpret sound as noise. And it's an interpretation. Watching your mind. Is this noise? Is this sound noise? What happens if we interpret it as noise? Probably there's a contraction in your body. A kind of resistance. A kind of separation. You separate yourself away. If it's, and there might be an emotional state that comes up as well. Anger, irritation, again a contraction, a separation. If it's just sound, something else happens. There's what I sometimes call a radical acceptance of the arising and passing and whatever the particular quality of the sound is. So there's an open heart, an open mind, receiving and connecting and knowing. And we're not always in this relationship to sound. But it's helpful to just notice. Notice watching your mind. Again, mindfulness. Noticing your response, noticing your reaction. And noticing without judgment. Just simply noticing. Noticing your relationship to sound in the midst of silence. Sometimes with silence, it seems as though all the windows of the world, all the windows of the universe have kind of been thrown wide open, allowing moments of freshness, allowing moments of clarity. Allowing moments of the boundless capacity of our heart to be present, to be accessible. Silence really can be quite a beautiful and very supportive container. And I think most of you have sat silent retreats before, so you're probably not particularly uncomfortable with the silence. Although sometimes there might be some anxiety about it. Days and days of silence and in the company of others. Maybe it'll be awkward. Maybe it'll be kind of strange. Maybe it'll be impossible after a while. But as probably many of you know, as a silent practice period goes on, many, many people feel that it's one of the most wonderful and supportive and beautiful aspects of a retreat kind of practice. In fact, it holds everything, but doesn't hold on to anything. Everything just simply comes and goes in the spacious, patient acceptance of silence. The key here is that you don't have to be anybody. You really don't have to be anybody special. You don't have to present yourself. I think many people spend a lot of life presenting ourselves. You don't have to do that. You don't have to become somebody. You don't have to become anybody. You just simply be. And it's often a great relief to just simply be. And the silence is really a big piece of this of the container of the retreat that allows this just being. And it's sometimes called noble silence or holy silence. And I think this is one of the reasons for that. It's really one of the aspects of retreat that allows for the boundless capacity of our heart to really become known, to be experienced. I'd like to read a poem that talks about this in a particular way by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. He calls it Keeping Quiet. To 12, and we will all keep still for once on the face of the earth. Let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales. And the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare dark wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers and sisters in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it's about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. This is the first support, silence. And I talk about it quite a bit because there's much more to it than just not talking. The second support that we have in a retreat like this is what's called taking refuge in the Buddhist teachings. So just looking at that for a few moments, what does it mean to take refuge? What is refuge? Safety is refuge. A shelter, a protection, a sanctuary, a protection from danger, protection from distress. Some time ago, I looked in the dictionary, I looked up the word refuge, and there was a particular part of that dictionary definition that I thought was quite appropriate to deep practice, or even not so deep practice. It said, it described refuge as a port of shelter for vessels in stormy weather. Sometimes our practice is like stormy weather. This place of safety. We're in this refuge, this shelter. And also we're in the shelter of each other. And that's an important aspect of refuge as well. The refuge of this retreat. And in the Buddhist teachings, we take refuge in three particular places or three particular energies. First, we take refuge in the Buddha. And this can mean a few different things, and it can mean different things to different people. We take refuge inwardly, maybe, and maybe we take refuge outwardly in the Buddha. Maybe we take refuge in the historical Buddha, Buddha Gautama, the teacher that, in fact, these teachings and these practices came from. Maybe we take refuge in that particular being. We could take refuge in the purity that's represented by the Buddha. We could take refuge in the freedom from suffering that's represented by the mind, that's represented by the heart of the Buddha. Maybe we take refuge in the inspiration that we feel in relationship to these teachings and practices that come from Gautama Buddha. And we also take refuge inwardly in our own Buddha nature. As we begin to uncover and to recognize the truth of ourselves, the truth of our heart, the truth of our mind, our own innate awakened nature, what in some traditions is called our original faith. And in relationship to this retreat, I'd say our original heart. This heart of pure care, open-hearted, friendship, connection. The second energy that we take refuge in is the Dharma, or the Dhamma in Pali, which literally means the teachings of the Buddha. We could say it another way. We take refuge in the truth. We take refuge in the universal laws of nature. So we take refuge in the way of things, the way it is. We take refuge in what is actually true from moment to moment to moment. And then do our best to live according to this truth, these truths. So in refuge in the Dhamma, we align ourselves with the way of things. We align ourselves with the Dhamma. So that's the second refuge. The third is taking refuge in the Sangha. And historically, the Sangha is, it's meant the monastic Sangha, the monks and nuns, those who were the followers, the disciples of the Buddha, and who let go of their ordinary worldly lives and committed themselves totally as monks and nuns to following the teachings and the practices. And on down through the centuries as this has continued. Without this monastic Sangha, actually, we wouldn't be sitting here this evening. It's really that Sangha, the monks and nuns, over centuries that have continued to carry the teachings country to country, century by century. And now, in our contemporary time, it's changed to some degree. There are many lay teachers, myself, like myself, and many others. So the Sangha, the meaning of Sangha, has expanded in that way, particularly in the West, or although this isn't the West, it's kind of like the West in some ways. That in even the larger sense, is everybody who's practicing, everyone who's interested and dedicated and devoted to the truth, to practicing and understanding the teachings and into developing their own heart and their own mind. So the Sangha is really quite broad. This Sangha right here. The Sanghas that you may have where you live, that you practice with at your in your home, at your home. It's really very important, this Sangha refuge. For non-Buddhist cultures don't support what we're doing, basically. We're a minority and we're not really supported in the midst of our culture. And so we need Sangha. We need each other. We need the support and the inspiration from each other, with each other. We need each other's encouragement. We need the strength that we give each other to keep going, to keep traveling this path, to keep going on this journey, to keep practicing to wake up, keep practicing to understand. because sometimes this path is not so easy, as I'm sure you each know to some degree. So these are the three energies, it is the three places that we take refuge in, which are sometimes called the three jewels. Because their essence is really sparkling, bright, beautiful, like jewels. So the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So this is the second support, the first being silence, and the second being refuge. And I'd like to talk just briefly about the third support, which is sila. Really translated, the word is usually translated as morality. And sometimes people have a little bit of a resistance to that word. I don't know in Israel if they do, but in the U.S. sometimes they do. I think it's helpful to take a look at this word sila, or this refuge of sila, in a broader way. It's really about living in an ethical relationship with all forms of life. Living with a very deep moral sensitivity towards and with all forms of life, including ourselves, very much also including ourselves. Metta, unconditional kindness, unconditional friendship, is really about living a life of sila, living a life of a deep moral sensitivity to all forms of life. As most of you probably know, the way that sila is offered is in the Buddhist teachings is through a group of precepts or guidelines. And I think an important aspect of this is that it's not about imposing these guidelines on ourselves, not about imposing these guidelines on others. They're not heavy-handed rules, so to say. They're not constraints. It isn't really at all what they are. The truth of them is that they're a support. As I mentioned, they're a support for us. So really coming to see and coming to know that the precepts or the guidelines are support. They're support for our practice. They're support for ourselves in a way of life. The underlying teaching beneath all of the precepts, beneath all of the guidelines, is pointing in the direction of non-harming. So that's why it's a support. It's about goodwill towards beings, which again is very much what metta is teaching and what our practice is about. Each of the precepts, each of the guidelines speaks about a particular aspect of our human life in relationship to non-harming. This practice of non-harming leads us away from actions, away from words, away from thoughts that create harm. That create harm both within ourselves and in relationship to others. So it's very practical, we could say. It's about life. It's about living our life. It also takes us out of the illusory sense of separation from others. Because we really begin to know what creates harm in relationship to life and what brings peace, what brings ease, what brings a sense of well-being, what brings a sense of connection. So the precepts, the guidelines, aren't abstract ideas. They're not an ideal about right or wrong. It's about really supporting our presence, our heartful, mindful presence in this life. And as we develop and understand sila, we begin to understand the fact of interconnectedness. We begin to see what creates harm, what creates ease in relationship to ourselves and ourselves in relationship to all beings and it just keeps expanding into the whole of life. Of course, the Buddha said it very well. This is a quote from the Buddha from the Dhammapada. He calls it harmlessness. All beings tremble before violence. All fear death. All love life. See yourself in others. Then whom can you hurt? What harm can you do? She or he who seeks happiness by hurting others, by hurting those who seek happiness, excuse me, she or he who seeks happiness by hurting those who seek happiness will never find happiness. For your sister, your brother, is like you. She, he wants to be at ease. Never harm her, never harm him. And you too will find ease, here and now, and after death. We received a sheet that has a particular version of the Refuges and Precepts on it. It's a particular version that was written by a woman named Stephanie Kaza. She wrote it some years ago when she lived at Green Gulch Zen, the Green Gulch Zen Center. I'd like to just read those out loud at this point, and then each morning at the very beginning of our first sit right after breakfast, our 8:30 sit, we'll chant these out loud together. I find that it's a wonderful way to begin our practice day. It really creates a container that's very helpful, very powerful. So this is Stephanie Kaza's poetic version of the Refuges and Precepts. And I particularly like it because at the beginning of each line, she tells us why we're practicing this. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to kill. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to take what is not given. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not engage in abusive relationships. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to speak falsely or deceptively. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harm self or other through poisonous thought or substance. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not dwell on past errors. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not speak of self separate from others. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not possess any thing or form of life selfishly. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harbor ill will toward any plant, animal, or human being. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not abuse the great truth of the three treasures, or the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So that's the third support, the teachings and the practice of sila, this practice of living ethically, of living with a deep moral sensitivity in relationship to all forms of life. I'd like to spend the last few moments of this evening exploring the practice of metta in a very particular way, from a particular perspective. And to begin, to first look at with you, where does this capacity to connect, where does this capacity to cultivate, to live with unconditional friendship, with unconditional kindness, where does this come from? own experience of kindness. The experience of receiving kindness from others. It comes from our own experience of receiving warmth, of receiving love, of receiving friendship that's been given to us freely from another. If you'd never, ever experienced this unconditional kindness, you would have an extremely, if not impossible, time with this practice. But fortunately, there are very few, very, very few people that have never experienced any unconditional friendship or unconditional kindness given to them. And in fact, I don't think we could live as a human being without having received at least some. And everyone in this room has probably received quite a bit. Just a simple example. Very simple example, actually. Not so long ago, when I was at home in New Mexico, in Taos, New Mexico, where I live, one morning I walked into the post office to get my mail. And someone opened the door for me and smiled at me. A connection with that person. I'd never seen the person before. I felt a connection. And I experienced a very genuine smile blossoming on my own face. We smiled at each other. We connected. That's a kindness given freely. Very simple, but true. Maybe as a child in school, in a classroom, you received kindness from a teacher who didn't embarrass you in front of the other students for something that you did or something that you didn't do. A very simple kind of kindness again. And of course, each of us have experienced kindness given to us from people that we know, with people that we're close to, that we care about. A kindness may be expressed with a more overt or stronger energy. That unconditional warmth of loving kindness given to us many times. So this is really what the seeds are. These are the seeds that have been planted in each of us many times. These are the seeds that we cultivate. These are the seeds that we grow. The kindness that we've been given is the kindness that we grow. The seeds that we water. The seeds that we're going to fertilize, we could say. That we're going to cultivate, that we give to ourselves, and then that we give out. It's like a circle. A transmission, we could say. We've been given the transmission by being given the kindness, and then we grow it, we cultivate it, and we give it out. Offer the transmission back. And it's this circle of growing and giving and receiving of kindness, of metta. So spending just a few moments this evening together and sitting quietly for just a few moments, settling into your breath, sitting comfortably. Beginning by giving the breath a primary attention, dropping in, noticing the breath wherever it's most directly and clearly felt in your body. Focusing the attention on just one breath at a time. Noticing the experience of breath as it comes into the body. And goes out of the body. Let yourself settle. staying present. Great. Attention clear, connected, breath by breath. Attention wanders off, thoughts come. Just simply notice it. And just simply let the thought go, as thoughts naturally do anyways. And then drop back into the inhalation or the exhalation with a mindful attention. Now we'll move into a few moments of some reflection. Spending a few moments reflecting on the kindness that's been given to you. Maybe from a friend or a family member, or maybe from a stranger. Letting the reflection flow freely, not trying to hold on to anything that comes up, not fixing on anything, not trying to keep anything. Noticing the various kindnesses that have been given to you. A parent, a teacher, an uncle, an aunt, a friend, a child. It doesn't have to be a big thing. Some small act of kindness, maybe today. Maybe something that comes up from many years ago. To receive kindness, to open to it and receive it, there's often a feeling of being respected, being appreciated. We often feel a little bit more open towards the being who's offering us whatever it is that they're offering us. In your reflection, you've noticed that you moved away a bit from opening to the other person. You ignored the kindness, or maybe dismissed it, or maybe didn't acknowledge it. Maybe this is the first time that you've acknowledged it. That we receive and that we give is always a gift. Every instance of unconditional loving kindness given to us involves people giving us their time, their care, their support, or in some way their help. Unconditional friendship, unconditional kindness given freely, it's a choice. A very natural choice that we and others make. And it has an effect on us. It has an effect on others. There's the talk with the instruction from the Buddha that we began with this evening. Say that we must train ourselves by liberation of the self through love. We will develop love. We will practice it. We will make it both a way and a basis. Take our stand upon it. Store it up. And thoroughly set it going.